You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Ian Benz, associate professor at UNC Charlotte in elementary science education. And my conspiracy theory that I hope is true is that Atlantis did exist and that they were very technologically advanced, and that hopefully if they ever come back, they can help me build a lightsaber.
Adam Pryor, I'm associate professor of religion at Bethany College. The conspiracy theory that I desperately hope is true is that street sharks will be returning soon.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. And by the time this episode airs, we will have passed September 20th, which is the date of the Area 51 raid, which has been canceled officially, but there's still 2 million people or so on the Facebook page who say that they're going to at least show up to raid Area 51, and they won't, but a couple of people probably will try to get close, and hopefully nobody gets shot. But wouldn't it be great if they were able to Naruto run past the bullets and get to the base and discover that there have been secret aliens all along?
My name is Kendra Holtmore, and Zach Jackson stole my conspiracy theory. So I'm going to say that I hope the moon landings were actually fake, not because there's not a moon, but because really those astronauts landed on Mars and they made it look like the moon, but secretly there's just already a colony living on Mars, and those astronauts don't think that the people are ready to know about it.
This is a conspiracy theory you legit invented right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rabbi Rachel Jackson of Hendersonville, North Carolina, at Agudas Israel. Conspiracy theory that I most wish were true is none. I know, I'm not playing along. I think conspiracy theories actually do more harm than good, because it puts a crack in our understanding of trust and our understanding of authority. And it might be fun and games unless somebody actually does believe it. And then if you are really persuasive, how do you unbelieve it? So I actually don't like conspiracy theories. Wet blanket attack.
Yeah, that just totally took the fun out of everything.
Is this because you used to work at the Denver airport and you are secretly a government agent?
We don't talk
you
about
did.
Those years.
You did talk about the Denver import airport a while ago, so.
And I could go into more detail, but I should.
No, but that, thank you for bringing us down to earth, Rachel. That is a good segue, because we are still talking about trust and the decay of trust in public institutions. And I wanted to start us off today with a story. A traumatic and terrible story. One of the worst days of my entire life. So here's what happened. I don't know if you've picked this up by now. I think we just... What is this episode? This episode would be episode number 7, 8? Yes. So we are currently recording episode number 8. So by this point, you probably know that I am an endless fount of useless knowledge. Not a whole lot that's useful or helpful, but useless, trivial knowledge is kind of my thing, which is one of the things that helps me in sermon writing. When people say, how did you know that? And say, well, it's been sitting in there for years with no one to tell it to, and now I'm using it as a sermon illustration and I seem brilliant. But really, this is just, my head is full of this useless stuff. And I love sharing all of those useless things. Like earlier, before we were recording, talking about the origin of the phrase knock on wood. So one day, way, way, way back in old 2010, back in the olden days, I was with my housemates and we were having tacos, and I shared with them that the hard shell taco was invented by Taco Bell. Fun fact, it's not a legitimate Mexican food. Was invented by Taco Bell. It's an American food. And my housemate said, "What? No, you're crazy. That's not true." And I said, no, it is true. They invented it. I saw it on the Discovery Channel. I know it's true." And he said, no, hold on a second. And he pulled out a smartphone. Yes, he pulled out the very first Android smartphone, the G1, if you remember this beautiful monstrosity. And he Googled it in front of me. To that point in my life, nobody had ever Googled something in front of me. They had never tried to fact check one of my random facts on the fly as I said it. People to that point, they just take me at my word for this fun fact that, wow, yeah, no, I always thought it was a real food, but Taco Bell invented it? That's crazy. All right, let's move on to the next thing. Zach is so smart, I can trust him on all these things. But within a minute, he revealed to me the truth that the founder of Taco Bell, Mr. Bell himself, Glenn Bell, claimed that he invented it, but he didn't. There are hard shell taco recipes in books that go back to the 50 years before Taco Bell even existed. There are patents filed before Taco Bell existed for devices to make hard shell tacos. It was already a widespread food in Southern California by the time that he started selling them in his Taco Bell restaurants. It was just that he was the first one that brought it mainstream, and then he went public and took credit for inventing it because he wanted an edge. Taco Bell started the year after McDonald's started, and this was his edge. And he took all the credit, and he didn't actually invent it. And in that moment, my entire life changed because I was wrong about something, and I was publicly shamed in front of all of my housemates and whoever we had over for dinner that day. And from that point on, any time I gave some fun historical fact, he would pull out his phone. And that Chris Pahulski, he would fact check me on the spot. And sometimes I was right, but most of the time I at least had some detail wrong. And I lost all credibility in my own mind and in his mind and in my housemates' minds. And I felt lost and alone and afraid. And even to this day, actually, the first sermon I preached at this church, we were talking about how the passage in scripture about there being a shoot growing from the stump of Jesse, and that I said, well, you know, that's a miracle that shoots don't grow out of dead stumps. And a guy came up to me after church and he said, "That's not true. That actually happens all the time." And at that point, I have no experience in arborology, whatever the study of trees is. And I was wrong.
It's called sorcery, but don't fact
check. Never heard that before.
Oh, knock on wood. Yeah. And the next time through, I felt like I lost his trust and that he was going to be much more wary of anything that I said from that point on. And it might have just been in my head, but I felt like I lost a lot of trust when I gave some fact and was wrong about it. And so I'm looking around at the decay of trust in our institutions, in our leaders, and I can't help but wonder how much of that has to do with the easy public dissemination of truth, of fact. I mean, Jerry Falwell Jr. was just in the news again because he had claimed some denial about being at some Miami party nightclub and said, "Oh no, this photo was photoshopped and I would never be in such a place as that." And then the photographer was like, "Oh no, you were. Here's 12 other pictures where you're in the background of this Miami nightclub partying with all of these people." And now there's all of these Liberty University people that are defecting on him because it's more and more is coming out. And would that sort of thing have happened in the past? Probably not. But now in this information age, with everything is photographed and everything is documented forever and everything is easily disseminated, it's very easy to discredit leaders, show them for the hypocrites that they are. And then, so then you lose trust in the authority of Falwell, which the man should have lost that a long time ago. But then he represents Liberty University, the largest Christian university in the world. I believe so. I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. It's been known to happen. Listener, feel free to pull out your T-Mobile G1 and Google it.
Can I ask something, though, about Go trust? Ahead. So to me, because, you know, I know I've said before, I am troubled by all of the just nonstop lying, fake news and stuff. But I feel like, at least for me personally, when a person admits that they're wrong about something, it actually helps me feel like I can trust them a little bit more when they own up to their mistakes. Right. So, and that's why, you know, if I'm wrong about something, I really do try to say, oh, okay, well, I didn't realize that. Let me verify that or something, just to acknowledge the fact that, you know what, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Like that's how I feel like we learn. And so, you know, I am a big fan of people owning up to mistakes when they make them. But and that's just me. So,
well, and that's fine with, you know, mistakes of like academic mistakes, getting the facts wrong, but the sorts of moral failings that a lot of the leaders in high places fall into, and then they try to cover those up because if they were to come out and admit it, then it could tear everything down. I can't think of a whole lot of people who have come out and admitted a moral failing and then come out the better for it.
Well, no, let me make something clear that, you know, it doesn't mean that, and that's a good point. I don't mean that, you know, moral failings or, you know, it means that I immediately start trusting them again or anything, or I don't feel like they need to be held accountable for their actions. I do believe people need to be held accountable for their actions. But I feel like when it at least shows that perhaps that person is on the path to recognizing that what they did was wrong.
And I would maybe add to what Ian is saying that perhaps if someone admitted a moral failing, took responsibility for it, I might respect that person, but that doesn't mean I would trust them with power, for example, if they were like an official or somehow in a position of power. I would be glad that they admitted their wrongdoings and respect the fact that that person took responsibility for it and was trying to be better. But it's a different question for me as to whether I should trust them again in that position. So I don't know. It seems like there's a separation for me between trust and respect, which is what I hear you may be talking about, Ian.
And that is, well, yeah, thank you for adding your two cents, because that helps me. Yes, what I missed in my, you know, statement is that yes, it does make it possible for me to potentially respect that person again, or at least respect the fact that they recognize that they're wrong and they're admitting to it. The trust issue is something that I feel like does need to be earned again.
One thing I heard, Zach, you saying, and as you're talking about being confronted with someone proving you wrong in the moment, right? Saying, oh, that theoretically useless fact, which I don't actually believe there are any such thing as a useless fact.
Thank you for affirming me.
Being, it might just be because I also love and store many of them, but being immediately proven wrong, or in a much harsher language, being called a liar. I think part of the trust issue is then trust within ourselves. So if somebody, we start faltering what we know, and if the person that we know the most, which is theoretically ourselves, if that person is not trustworthy, if that person doesn't have what they believe to be right, because most of us don't want to live in a world where we're like, I know I'm wrong and I'm okay with that. I'm going to continue to be wrong, whether that's a factual or a moral place. I don't believe many of us exist in that. I think that we try to be factually and morally upright. That might be my naivete coming out again, though. So if we lose trust in ourselves, if someone is pointing at us, and one of the words that you really used there, Zach, was shame, right? Shame is that emotion. Shame is embarrassment in public. And it causes some deep rifts in a person. So if we lose the trust in ourselves, then how can we possibly lend trust to someone that we don't know as well? So that was more of a rhetorical question, part one. Part two, these ridiculous little devices that so many of us are beholden to. We sort of say in the some Jewish circles, well, let me just ask Rav Google. Because you go to your rabbi because your rabbi knows things. Your rabbi is able to give you a decision on Jewish law. And so we're saying, oh, well, Google is the one actually able to make those decisions, Rav Google. And in our modernity, in our meaning the last couple hundred years, we have become such a global society, such a society where we do know so much more about, in tiny little ways, about so many more things, right? We have less of a depth of knowledge of something and a massive breadth of knowledge. And how can we possibly be expected to maintain all of that in our brains when we're wired for social connection, meaning that we attempt to find connection to places, even if that means in our heads, we sort of fill in the gaps, fill in the stories somewhere. So I want to give this generation kind of a benefit of the doubt and a little bit of slack, because so much is coming at us all at once. I think that shakes us at our core, especially when it comes to trust. And then with the technology piece, and as we posted a couple weeks ago, deep fake videos and right, we're now able to synthesize a person's voice, and now we can synthesize their looks. And then one other thing, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot right now. One other thing, right? We were saying we can capture all of this, but we also recognize that when we do capture all of this, it's only captured from that one person's perspective. And we can see that when, right, some high school students and a Native American tribe member were clashing. And initially it was one person's fault, and then it was the other person's fault. And then it turned out it was just a really bizarre situation. But if you only saw one perspective, then of course your truth, your trust there was wrong.
Related to like technology in the information age, I think that it's a double-edged sword, because I think there's something valuable about losing trust in the things that we so easily take for granted, not to such an extent that we find them like useless, or that we like get to a point where we're unable to have any trust in those people or institutions anymore. But I do think there's something really valuable about like having access to information that encourages us to question the legitimacy of the things that we believe and the people that we believe. And I think that the problem for me is not so much, you know, the way that technology in the information age makes it easier to, you know, spread fake news. Like, obviously, that's a huge problem. And I am often terrified by a lot of technological advancements. But I think that those things are inevitable. And where my deeper concern lies, I guess, is that I want I want people to be able to learn a better discourse with each other in light of increasing technology that like gives us so much access to information. I think we need to, in some ways, embrace that and learn how to sift through it responsibly. And I think that's not an easy task. And I know that that will be like a painful, long process. But it seems like when I hear people talking about the information age, a lot of times the conversation tends to stay around the fact that we just, like, the problem is the technology, the fact that we can make these deep fake videos. And while I agree, I want us to like get to the next step of just figuring out, like, in light of something that is probably never going away, how do we use that technology responsibly? And I think that's a really important conversation that we have to start having with maybe more urgency. And so, yeah, it's the double-edged sword. It's great. We can like know more and question the things we believe, but also I don't think that we need to destroy all institutions. Like I do think we need to have like a broad sense of trust in society and in our governance. Like I think that that is important, while at the same time like holding that tension of like, to what extent is it acceptable to have the kind of trust that you can take for granted and like not have to worry about the people who have authority over your lives. And I know that's that kind of I think that sense of trust changes from age to age, but I don't know, it feels very hard for me to just look at trust as something that's a totally positive concept. And mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know, I'm curious how that lands for y'all.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at popular culture. What are the big movies now? So many of the like the young adult novels and the big blockbuster movies have to do with like dystopian nightmares of corrupt establishments, whether that be political or educational, or you know, things are not as they seem. And there was this, I mean, we were obsessed, and we still are to some extent, with vampires, which are the perfect monster for that kind of thing. They look normal, they look like us, but you can't trust them, because then they turn into something else that they actually are underneath. And zombies are the other big one. And what's a zombie but one of us that has been corrupted and is the one that you love who's now turned on you, and you can't trust anyone. And all of our, like, do you guys watch any of the Netflix Marvel shows?
I did for a little bit.
I watched Jessica Jones for a while.
I think they're the best thing that Marvel has done. And my wife and I are currently binging the last season of Daredevil. And I won't give any spoilers, but the whole thing is predicated on, you can't trust the church, they've lied to you. You can't trust the government, they're all bought and paid for. You can't trust law enforcement, they're all in the pockets of the mobsters. You can't trust the justice system, because the rich will find a way to get out of it. You can't trust vigilantes, because who's regulating them? You can't trust anyone except for sometimes your friends. But in this season, no, you can't trust your friends either. You really can't trust anyone except maybe yourself, and only sometimes. And I was watching it last night, thinking about this conversation today, and thinking like, well, yeah, I get that. I get that zeitgeist that's in the air, that you can't trust any organization, any establishment. And it's all because the things that you've learned, we've learned how the sausage works, how the sausage is made, not how it works. It works because it's a tube of meat. But how it's made in very ugly ways. And we're used to just be able to accept it and know that things happen behind closed doors, and we don't love what happens, but it happens. But now we know, and we know all of the dark secrets. And so the institutions that are full of people who are flawed, who are corrupt in many cases. Now we know about the corruption, and now we can't trust them. And then that bleeds over into every other establishment and institution. And then we're alone. And what do you do? I don't know. I have two more episodes left.
But I think that gets to the whole idea something, you know, Kendra used this phrase too, of institutional trust. And, you know, I am bothered when I something happens between a friend and myself or acquaintance or just someone I know, and I feel like I can't trust them as well anymore. But I think, you know, what really bothers me is when you feel like you can't trust the institutions anymore. I feel like that could be more detrimental to society. Because, you know, if you, and then when the people who are advocating you can no longer trust an institution to have a platform. So, you know, the easiest example right now is media. And you have our president saying that media is the enemy of the people and the enemy of the United States, and everything they say is fake news if he disagrees with it. And then you have his supporters who just jump on board and say right away that that's right, it's fake news. You know, he said it's fake news, so it's fake, even if, you know, the facts are clear that the information is not fake. It doesn't matter anymore. All that matters is that the messenger is saying it's fake. And to me, what bothers me is that it could take a really long time to rebuild that trust within institutions because of the actions of that we're seeing right now. And, you know, media and the president is the easiest example to think about, but there are plenty of other examples of people losing trust within the scientific establishment. And we see that within politics as well. And you lose trust within the church and religion. And it really troubles me that that's becoming such a big thing right now.
I just posted a link to an image from the Pew Research Center that you should check out. I find it fascinating, because they this is a poll they did the end of last year, as the percentage of adults in each age group with a great deal slash fair amount of confidence in different institutions. And seeing the age gap is noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're over 50, 91% of people have a good amount of confidence in the military. Yep. If you are 18 to 29, it's only 69%. 71% of the oldest have trust in religious leaders, but only 50% of the youngest. That same kind of differential is true for police officers and business leaders. The only one where, though there's three where the youngest have more trust than the oldest. And they are scientists, journalists, and college and university professors.
The sources of information from a factual, verifiable, accredited source is what the young people are looking at, as opposed to the military, the religion, the community leader, right? Because that's what a business and a police officer and a religious leader, those are community leaders. But someone who is a scientist, a journalist, and a professor have different accredited standards. And I think that's why we see this shift. Although it is also of note that the younger people, in this case, young means 18 to 29 years of age. So that would, are those all millennials? Or there's, I don't understand the generational
differences. Millennials
are
usually 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it's a cross between. So that the spread between those is actually very, very little, with the exception of college professors, where the spread is still only 11. But in terms of the scientists and the journalists, there's a lot of overlap. So really the only difference we're seeing is a decrease in communal leaders the younger a person is. And I think that does map onto the use and trust of technology, where our community has suddenly become very large, where you don't, right? And we are seeing the corruption within those leaders, right? I mean, think about when the Catholic Church had/has their scandal. right? So we had the biggest issue is that priests were abusing young boys or young children. But an even harder thing to swallow was that they weren't then punished. They were just shuffled around and it was hidden under the rug. And so they weren't responsible. They didn't take action. They made it worse. And that happened, you know, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, which are these two lower demographics. So the why would I trust an institution that lies to me in these ways to protect themselves and their own? And not to mention all of the other business leaders that we have seen fall from grace.
Ugh. Well, one of the findings, though, from this particular Pew survey is that I do find it very interesting is that the only group that is trusted by more than 80% in all age groups is scientists.
Yep.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Everything else, at least one of the age groups is below 80%.
Yeah, from the...
I find that really interesting.
From the article that I mentioned in last week's episode, faith in scientific institutions has remained fairly constant among mm-hmm. all demographic groups, regardless of age, except for those who are self-identified as politically conservative or people who regularly attend church. Those are the only two demographics, regardless of age and gender and controlling for all other socioeconomic aspects. Those are the only two people groups that have shown a decrease in trust in science. And most of that can be chalked up to politicization, thank you so much, of certain scientific regulatory institutions. I mean, right now, so back then you could see, you know, the EPA and OSHA and these scientific organizations that are then telling businesses what they can't do. And then so the party that's in more in line with business then gets anti those scientific institutions. And then, so they're out of their tribe and you end up with some animosity there. Now we're seeing that even NOAA is political now, where the most ridiculous, stupidest scandal I think I have ever seen in my entire life, where the president tweets that all these states are going to be hit, probably, and one of them is not actually going to be hit. He just made a mistake. And instead of admitting, oh, nope, sorry, was a mistake, it doubles down because the weather agency in Alabama released a tweet saying, hey, don't panic, don't worry, because they were getting flooded with calls that am I going to get hit? And they said, no, don't worry, don't panic. You know, there's like a 1% chance that it's going to hit. And instead of just ignoring this like it never happened or admitting that you're wrong, he doubles down. Yep. And then he has to then rewrite facts. And then we end up with Sharpiegate, which is a ridiculous name. They really should be calling it Benghazi, but we're going to go with Sharpiegate, where he shows a very clearly modified map with just a Sharpie addition at the end, who then he claims he didn't do it, and maybe he didn't. Maybe he had doodled on it before and didn't realize it was doodled on when he showed it to the crowd. But and then the people at the NOAA releases a statement about it, and then they're like, "Why are you contradicting your own scientists?" And then there's this reports of people being hushed within because you don't want to damage the president's ego, and just this kind of nonsense is the reason mm-hmm. why we're seeing the decrease in trust among organizations. If something that is supposed to be a non-partial scientific organization has these political ridiculousness going on inside of it, then we're going to drag down that trust in scientists to the point where the trust in elected officials is, which even the highest percentage of trust of elected officials is only 38%. So we don't trust
the lowest is only
officials.
34. Like, I mean, nobody.
No, we're pretty agreed on that. We don't trust elected officials unless they're in our party, and then we love them.
So I just want to say I do need to go, but I wanted to add like a last comment before I go, if I can. Mm-hmm. But since I have to go, I would like to say it now, which is, okay, so the graph that we're looking at, I think it's interesting that even though we see the higher numbers of the younger demographic trusting in roles like scientists, journalists, college professors, whatever, it's interesting because I don't think that it's necessarily about those people trusting that position so much as it is about trusting the idea of that position that matches like the values that you have. And maybe another way to put that is that, sure, maybe this survey is showing that millennials trust scientists, but if you like split the different kinds of millennials, like what does it mean to be a scientist that's worthy of trust? Because there are all kinds of different ways to be a scientist, and some of those ways we wouldn't even call science. But and I think the same is true for journalists. Maybe is even a better example than scientists. Journalists are writing from like different political perspectives. And to say that you have trust in a journalist, is it about trusting journalism or is it about trusting the journalists that you read because they are supporting a Republican or a Democratic understanding right. of government? So I think that's one note that I think is interesting because it seems to me that the next question would be about like how to build trust, which I think is more about the like soft power of shared values and shared relationships and the kinds of intangible things that are harder to grasp and harder to like make concrete plans about how to like build those things up between people. And I think that is really like where we find trust between people. And I think that this naturally connects to people's religious identities and things that are just a lot harder to talk about when you are seeing them mixed in with politics, especially in America, where we're supposed to have this like separation of religion and politics, which is not actually how it works on the ground. But this question of trust, I think, forces us to look at the way we are like utilizing those forms of religiousness, those forms of soft powers to manipulate people to further a political goal that we have. And I think we see that happening all the time. So yeah, anyway, that's what I wanted to add.
Thank you, Kendra. And I know that we're going to be talking about politics and religion in upcoming episodes. One thing in that communal way that I'm wondering, when we're looking at surveys, right, that it's they don't give us all the information. So when we do look at the respondents, one thing that I wonder about the respondents then is this generation, the two younger generations listed, the 18 to 29 and 30 to 50, tend to have gone to college more than those that are over the age of 50. So is there my friends are scientists and my friends are, university professors, or I've interacted with them. And because I've been able to make the personal connection with them, then I'm able to find more trust in them. And if we look at the number of people who are affiliated with a religious organization, the numbers are similar in the sense that
the lower the affiliation, the lower the trust. And so you don't trust an organization that you don't have a relationship with. So maybe, you know, it is going back to those relational.
And what's the effect to that?
Does it have to be so black and white, though? Can it not be more circular?
It makes me think about a couple of terms that a scholar in religion and science, his name's Wenzel Van Hoystein, kind of introduced, I don't know, probably 20 years ago or so now, to sort of how we think about the relationship that people have to religion and to science as sort of distinct fields, right? And he put forward these two terms that have been really helpful to me. One is experiential adequacy, and the other is epistemological adequacy. It's basically just a fancy way of saying, right, that like when we enter into these relationships of trust with either other persons or other fields, right, we're always sort of working between these two sets of adequacies that we're trying to maximize. So on the one hand, we want a set of experiences that makes the information or the sets of persons that we're working with trustworthy to us. On the other hand, there are sets of epistemological knowledge, factual concerns, right, that grant a sort of inherent sense of trust. But we never completely separate those two sorts of things, right? And so when I'm looking at this list and I'm thinking about these sort of questions that we have about why this flip in demographic generations, there's part of me that wonders a lot in the same way that I think Rachel is, about what's the role of that experiential adequacy in the way that we trust different groups. If I don't have an experience with that community, does it make it harder for me to trust them? Whereas, right, the sort of minimal difference that we see in like scientists to me is really interesting. Those are the purveyors of epistemological adequacy. Doesn't matter whether we have an experience with them or to some extent, right? But like these are the folks who are supposed to give us real facts, quote unquote, about the world. And so there's less of that experiential piece that maybe factors into how people would respond. As a college and university professor, I'm particularly interested in that one because suddenly I'm like more trustworthy than pastors. And I'm like, that I never thought I would live to see the day where that was the case. I'm quite seriously. I mean, I really, that to me is the one that is sort of most interesting and most surprising to me because and I think you're seeing that sort of borne out, right? That role of the religious leader, that role in creating experiential relationship and having that sort of experiential adequacy in how we trust people has fallen away in these sort of interesting categories. So to me, it's really fascinating, but it's an interesting question for religion and science, right? Where are the ways in which those two fields and the folks who are purveyors of those fields creating relationships of trust in wider communities? And should that be thought of as sort of part of the role?
I think it comes back to, you know, something you want to talk about, institutional trust earlier, but the idea that, you know, we know that we have a problem with trust in our country. And so I mean, you guys know me, I like to try to see it, start to discuss possible ways to help improve that, help to make it so that we can see an improvement in people's trust of institutions, because it could really damage societies. And so, you know, I think it would be interesting for us to kind of get into that discussion a little bit about, you know, if we just want to focus on the two areas that we are here to focus on, with science and religion, what are things people can do to help improve trust? And, you know, as we said, with the scientists section, it's pretty high already. I'm not saying we don't need to continue to work on that, but I think it, you know, especially with religious institutions, I didn't really notice that as much at first, Adam, like you said, but it is interesting to me that professors and some of these age groups have a higher level. There's more trust in professors than there is in religious leaders, which is, I mean, yeah, I'm a professor, so I'm like, whoa, but still it's, interesting that's kind of what we're seeing with the younger generation. So I'm just curious, what are things that can be done?
Well, okay, so I'll take a stab at that one first, because yes. I think about it a lot, right? So in particular, because I teach about religion, this is sort of interesting piece, right? Like I joke with colleagues sometimes that like I really spend the first 3 weeks of the semester just convincing the students that it doesn't matter whether or not I'm religious, right? Hmm. Which now that I'm looking at a survey like this is really just like propping up my credentials as a professor and someone you can trust, right? The crux of that, though, is then to really help students see that, one, we can look at religions in an academic way, but two, to say that not all religious people are zealots who you should write off, and that there is a trust that should be shown to deep commitment within religious communities, right? I think that's one way of describing what it is that I try to do in the classroom. It isn't to say that you have to adopt that religious perspective, but you do have to consider it as a valid way of engaging the world. And so for me, right, like a big part of what I think of as like my vocation as a professor is to build that kind of trust for students who may have had really poor experiences with religion.
So it occurs to me that in religious institutions, institutional trust can be eroded by individual misconduct. So if the pastor of a church has an affair with the secretary and steals money from the church and lies about the whole thing or whatever it may be, then there are a lot of people that will then lose trust in the institution of the church. That all religion is ridiculous and it's all just a bunch of people. But you have the same thing happen to a professor, and it's not like the faith in the entire institution of higher learning is then tainted. And I wonder if it's an issue of, you know, where our authority comes from, that we as religious leaders, despite what we may say, are seen as the purveyors of divine revelation and divine truth. And so when we fail, it's reflects as a failing on God and less so for academia and the other institutions that are on that list. I'm not sure what it is, but it does seem to be that there is a whole lot of pressure on us as individual church leaders or religious leaders to not screw up. Because if we do, we risk ruining the credibility for our entire institution. I have told my people from day one, like, I am not that pastor that you put up on a pedestal. I am not ever going to pretend to have some high moral ground or some high spiritual ground or to be some kind of super antenna for the divine. I am not that pastor who is the pillar that you can rest your faith on. And this is why I didn't want to be a pastor, but I felt so called to be an example of how to be vulnerable and weak and open and honest in your failings so that people wouldn't look to me, that they would look past me to God. And the more I do that, I have found, and this isn't true for everyone, but for many people, that then causes them to put me on a different pedestal that, oh man, this pastor, he is just so humble and he is so real. And, oh, I wish I could be as honest as he is. And the sort of moral strength he must have to be so weak. Oh, it's so wonderful. And so I can't win. You're going to find a pedestal to put me on. And I'm going to inevitably fall off of it because I can't stand on even the pedestal that I told you I couldn't stand on before. And when I fail and when I fall, it's going to negatively impact somebody who had built their whatever fledgling faith on me. And I think the whole system of clergy as is doomed to fail.
And to me, that's a real difference in the experiential adequacy, right? That to me is like the sort of key example about like that these different sorts of careers, they play really different roles in the trust that gets formed with a community because of what they represent in terms of the experiences both that people are bringing to that relationship and that they're expecting out of it culturally, right? And so So that to me is sort of the sort of catch-all piece here, right? Religious leaders play a really different role, in how trust is established than a scientist or than a college university professor. And there are almost different rules to the game that we have to use to create that trust then.
I just shared another link in episode preparation from that same source where you got your chart that I think is interesting. We talk about trust, you know, and I was asking about, you know, ways that, and I think that's part of what we're exploring is how we can use our platform to help people. But when you look at the thing I just showed you about, you know, the way different generations view U.S. adults, people in our country itself, that I think it's really interesting that the younger generation views that, like, overwhelmingly says that most of U.S. adults are selfish, that they look out for themselves, they take advantage of you, and that most people cannot be trusted.
I'm in that category. Not that I can't be trusted, but that I don't trust the common the common folk. Maybe yeah. I've just watched too many dystopian nightmare movies that
maybe just are... But this whole idea that people are just looking out, you know, it's just, I find that so interesting that the older you go or the older generations are saying that no, people can be trusted.
Well, and the older generations had a lot more propaganda from the government of American unity and that we're all in this together, and you know, the kind of post-war optimism of America that really fell apart in the 60s and 70s and now into today. And Adam's gonna pull my head off.
No, I love that people won't be able to see the like sort of like anxiety that just caused in both Rachel and I as you were saying it.
Right, because apparently you are in the 65 and older.
Clearly, I skipped right over my mid-40s to like 65. I'm trying to get there every day. You know, I wear socks and sandals just for fun. But like, no, I
don't knock it. It's super comfortable.
I totally agree. It is really comfortable. No one should sort of make fun of people who do
that. All those people who say it's not are just crazy.
Yeah, they just don't know. That also should be like a theme that we could like be pushing out there. I think that's actually one of our roles and maybe an important part of our vocation on this show is to make socks and sandals really acceptable. Wow.
If we can get Dr. Scott, the paleontologist, to come on with and endorse socks and sandals, then
that would just be it. Oh my gosh, I'd go crazy. Yeah.
So I think the piece to me that is interesting about this too, right, is that I think it has something to do with like... I think it has something to do with the way in which we think of ourselves as part of a community that's shifted. And I think it also has something to do with the sorts of problems we face and what sort of responses people are imagining people are making in light of those problems, right? So I feel like I should give an example, right? In terms of the like community commitment piece, right? I live in a really small town, and that gives me a very different sense of what it looks like. Like I would wonder, most people can't be trusted, if that would change if you started like particularly looking at U.S. adults in rural versus urban demographics. Is there something about how you know your neighbor, right? And the ways in which you know your neighbor that starts to affect where you might put yourself on that and how you'd respond to that question. But also, right, the problems that we faced. The problems of a post-World War II sort of America were very different than the problems of global warming, right? Hmm. And, you know, what a group of 18 to 29-year-olds looking at a world that they're going to inherit that has been ruined, largely in the face of good scientific evidence that said we needed to change our behaviors.
Right.
It's a pretty rational answer to say, yeah, most of the time people are looking to take care of themselves and just take advantage if they get a chance. Because that's what they've seen, right? And I think that's a major shift that has to be acknowledged, that because of the responses that have been offered to the problems those generations face have shifted so much. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I just actually think it's a pretty rational response that we see there.
So we are past our time. So
I need some optimism.
So
okay. We need some optimism.
Yeah, we need something good to end the show on.
That's because you're pastors and not professors. We'd be totally happy just stopping right there. Anxiety, fear, depression. I got all the things that I need for a class. It's done.
Oh, man. Well, give me 3 points of application that start with the same letter. And
I trust you all. And that's how I think we should end it, that we all trust each other. Let's do a kumbaya moment.
Oh, man. I'd rather not. Institutional trust is so important because we cannot exist as a society without trusting some greater institution rather than just ourselves or those who are within immediate proximity to us. But at the same time, institutions are no longer granted carte blanche. Institutions now must earn the trust of the people. Each generation that comes is seeing more and more of the historical foibles and the mistreatment that those in power have gotten, and they've seen that no matter which political party, no matter which religion or which institution, if there is power and money in play, there will most certainly be some amount of corruption. And we know too much to turn back. And so it is really difficult to trust in large scales. So I think in a religious community, I can only work in the small scale. I can work to build trust in my church and then in my community. I can build trust in my institution here. I can't help build trust for the entire church or the entire religion or religion itself. I can't do that. I can hopefully create an open place where we have no secrets. And if there is something dark, we deal with it in public, come what may, instead of trying to hide it. The cover-up is always worse than the crime. And I think it's something that I want to end on a really positive, optimistic note here, that all we have to do are these 3 things, and trust will be reestablished, and utopia will reign, and everything will be wonderful. But it's not, because we've
we're going for the Marvel comic universe and the Star Trek universe. We're not doing DC and Star Wars.
This is why I'd be a bad cult leader. I can't just end there.
You can.
No, I can't. Because.
No, that's just
because
all the
we
way.
Have had such a bad track record in religious institutions.
Shh.
And it took so long to erode public trust that it's going to take just as long to gain it back. And I think it is a worthwhile venture.
Probably longer.
And it is it is going to be the work of my lifetime and my children and their children and their children and generations of people trying to rebuild the trust in institutions. And the trust that will be rebuilt in an information age where you won't be able to hide as much. And whatever that looks like, I can't predict the future because I will be wrong. But I do know that we will keep working, we will keep going, and whatever world we create, we will leave better than the one that we inherited. This has been episode 8 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to go on this journey with us. If you like what you hear, do us a favor and leave a review on iTunes. It might not seem important, but it does help more people to find the show. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to all our social media accounts. We have now officially finished our introductory series and are moving on to our first topical series on, ready for this? The separation of church and state. Yeah, we're going there. And you're not going to want to miss it. Until next time, Charlie, say hi to all the nice internet people out there.
Hi. To internet people.